right, I'll start. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, but especially if you're not receiving this on my podcast feed or if you're watching it on YouTube with video, you can tell this is not just an episode of Everyday Anarchism. This is a crossover event. So I'll turn it over to my co-host to introduce themselves and their podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm Peter Michael Bauer, and this is the Rewilding Podcast. I'm really excited to co-host an episode. I've never really done something like this before. To post simultaneously. Yeah. I appreciate the concept of your podcast.
I think I did it once with Sean of Seriously Wrong, which is probably the majority of my listeners, I think, came from that episode, but I haven't done it for years. So as I was telling Peter before we started recording, I was like, I'm confused. Like, do I talk? Simultaneous hosting is confusing. I guess I'll start, which is to say, I was not familiar with your work. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say I was not even familiar with rewilding as a concept for humans. Obviously, I was aware of the rewilding movement. You would have to really be not paying attention to mainstream media to not know that, especially in the UK, there's this big movement of, returning the land to the wild. And we'll have to get into what the wild means and nature and all of this stuff. But you've been doing this for decades. And I think rewilding the land is undoubtedly part of what you're interested in, but it's not your main thrust. So why don't you start by explaining what rewilding is?
Yeah, sure. So in the 1980s in Eugene, Oregon, or the West Coast, Earth First was, generated. If you're not familiar with Earth First, it's a direct action activist organization that was developed to stop clear cuts for the most part. And they operated and are still in some level of operation. I think at least they had a blog. They used to have a newsletter. They did a lot of tree sits and things like that and raised awareness about logging operations in the Northwest. During that time, the word rewilding started to be used among the activist community within Earth First. Some of them were using it for a type of conservation, and some of it were going beyond that and using it for like a cultural rewilding. It kind of morphed from there. I think, I've heard stories that Dave Foreman was kicked out of Earth First or that he left of his own accord. but he went on to start a conservation organization called Wildlands Institute and wrote a book about conservation rewilding. Meanwhile, you have the sort of deepening of leftist ideology within Earth First. You have anarchism kind of central in Eugene because you have people like John Zerzan, who has Anarchy Radio and things like that. And they start publishing a magazine in the early 2000s called Green Anarchy Magazine. And one of the main issues was about rewilding. And that's how I came across the idea of cultural rewilding, was through Green Anarchy Magazine. And not that I hadn't been doing it already, I just didn't really have a word to describe what I was doing, And I had been shy to embrace the idea of anarchy or anarchism, mostly because of the public distortion of, what it means. And so kind of coming to that as a leftist and sort of starting to realize and understand the difference between like liberalism and leftism or leftist, that magazine really helped kind of define my idea of what anarchy could be. And so to me, rewilding in terms of the cultural rewilding is really fundamentally about returning to a kind of primal anarchy, is what they call it now, but anarcho-primitivism was what they called it for many years. The idea being that for the majority of human evolution, we lived in stateless, non-hierarchical societies. And so if we look at the idea of what are humans adapted to best through millions of years of evolution, socially, that would be anarchy. And so to me, it just that made plenty of sense. I'm not like a well-read anarchist. I haven't read all of the stuff. I've read Peter Kropotkin, I've read some Emma Goldman and things like that, but I'm not like deep in the scene of anarchy, I think in part my version of rewilding was sort of trying to blend pop cultural motifs and aesthetics with these ideas so that they could more subversively enter mainstream. And for doing so, like wearing American Apparel clothes in the mid-aughts when that was still a thing, and talking about rewilding, you know, kind of actually alienated me in a lot of ways from the anarchist subculture. So I've never really been integrated into that in that way, but I am an anarchist. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm attracted to your podcast is the idea of everyday anarchism, making it accessible to people, I feel, so that you don't have to feel like you have to become part of some subculture in order to be an anarchist. At least that's sort of, you know, my sort of incline toward it. Yeah, so that's kind of the brief history of rewilding in a nutshell, cultural rewilding. Of course, in the last decade, so you mentioned the UK, you know, if you had Googled rewilding before 2014, you would have come across mostly green anarchy, anarcho-primitivism, rewilding, cultural stuff on the internet. George Monbiot is a British man, author. He wrote this book called Feral about conservation rewilding in England, and the book blew up. And so it's been 12 years since that book kind of exploded. And it really, you know, turned the tides in terms of public consciousness of what rewilding was. So the conservation side of things is now what most people think of when they hear the word rewilding because of the sort of rise in popularity of conservation rewilding. But in the length of time that the word has been in popular use or in use at all, it's actually meant both these two separate things. And at one point in time, cultural rewilding seemed to be the one that was going to sort of dominate public awareness. And then unfortunately, it's gone the other direction with conservation rewilding being the more well-known form of rewilding. And I don't, that's fine because I still believe conservation rewilding is a net good in terms of everything. But it's also sad because it's still, because conservation rewilding is still something that we see like under the purview of the state, right? So it's not actually like any kind of anarchy. It doesn't emerge from that at all. All that comes out of that is the state kind of reframing how it does conservation, you know? Which in and of itself, there are actually through lines that can move the conservation rewilding towards a more cultural rewilding through things like indigenous land management practices that are now being embraced by a lot of conservation organizations, which historically were not. And so I think that there is a bridge happening there. But it's still going to be something that is ultimately ruled over by state powers, you know? And so in that sense, I think cultural rewilding is always going to be more radical than conservation rewilding. And then you also see, you know, just like anything that becomes popular in any way, you see a co-option of cultural rewilding. So you see the introduction of, you know, diet, exercise, product lines, like paleo diet type things. You know, you can now take a class on how to rewild your butthole or whatever. I don't know. You know, like there's influencers who are like, you need to sun your asshole like for an hour a day or something. I don't know. You know what I mean? There's just stuff like that. And they call it rewilding. And really that in and of itself also takes away from the more radical aspects of primal anarchy. And so I've been kind of I've been around for a long time. And my whole thing is basically trying to remind people or introduce people to the idea, the core ideas that cultural rewilding emerged from, which is a return to a kind of relationship with place that is anarchic in its essence.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, that sounds great. Sorry, listeners and viewers, I'm still trying to figure out who's hosting this thing. Cause my thought was to go on with follow-up questions about that, but I guess I should briefly introduce myself and my podcast for the people who are, you know, on the other side. So, I mean, I guess first, I can address sort of who I am and what I do in response to what you were saying. I'm an anarchist. I mean, I think if that word has any meaning related to ideas. I'm an anarchist. I have a podcast about anarchism. But also, I'm also not integrated into, you know, the anarchist subculture. So I work at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And for a while, there was a guy who would come to the quad that would give out anarchist pamphlets. And I chatted with him. And I was just like, man, I'm ready. I've been making this podcast for a few years. What do I do? And he was just like, oh, no, there's no anarchists here. They all got arrested. And some of them are in prison. And then they had the ones that weren't arrested had a big infighting and the anarchist scene totally disappeared. So you got to drive 40 minutes to find anarchists. Now, I mean, yeah, that's a bit of an exaggeration. There's a really, really free market, that sort of thing. But like, sure, I have not succeeded in integrating into an anarchist culture. And then the other thing I'll say, I mean, this is, you know, I don't know how you feel, but when I make a podcast, I kind of just end up relating whatever I've been thinking about the past week to the topic at hand. And it's just like, man, I would have said a totally different thing if I hadn't just happened to read that thing. But there's, since I'm an academic, I'm kind of adjacent to this field called anarchist studies. I'm hoping to attend the conference, the Anarchist Studies Network conference. But I quickly figured out that, well, I have a lot of overlap with a lot of those people, especially this figure, Ruth Kinna, who I've had on my podcast a number of times. A lot of them, it's almost more like anarchists' studies. Like they're less interested in the ideas and they're more interested, it's almost like a sociological approach. Sure. Who is calling themselves an anarchist? What are the anarchists doing? When did the anarchist movement begin? And so if you approach it from this Kropotkinian claim that like, anarchism is basically mutual aid and cooperation and non-domination, and it goes back at least to Jesus and Lao Tzu. But in fact, you can take it back not only to all of human civilization, but in fact, you know, to the natural world. Then if that's what you're attuned to, this set of ideas and practices and processes, which is what I'm trying to do, a group of academics who are really interested in what someone wrote in a pamphlet in 1892. It's just, there's nothing wrong with the work they're doing, but I'm just like, but I don't care about this stuff. And let's talk about Lao Tzu. And they're like, yeah, but you're doing something ahistorical because Lao Tzu didn't call himself an anarchist. And I'm like, well, I'm trying to trace this set of ideas in our everyday life. You know, when you're in a classroom, the classroom can be more hierarchical or more anarchic. When you're walking down the street can be more hierarchical and more anarchic. When you're in a conversation, there can be one host who drives the conversation and then one guest who is supposed to be in charge of providing the content to fit the host's form. Or it can be something more anarchic where you don't know who is in charge. And that's when I say everyday anarchism, that's what I'm interested in, with the claim that in general things work better, everyone is happier the more anarchist things are. And then essentially the history of ideas, which you can say is 500 years old or 200 years old or 12,000 years old, the history of ideas besides anarchism is basically a series of claims from the first kings through Plato, through the Economist, through Donald Trump, that actually someone needs to be in charge. Everyone needs to be punished if they're doing it wrong. And if you leave people alone, I mean, one way of putting it is like civilization is the claim that someone has to be in charge and things will only work with hierarchy, domination, and power. And that's, it's first of all, it's obviously not true.
Right.
It's not how people live their lives. And so the thing I'm trying to do is find every time in the history of ideas that either A, someone has made this claim, you know, someone needs to be in charge. Here's an example I use all the time. Oh my God, now I'm yammering. I used to have this boss who would say like, you know, there always has to be one person who's in charge. And I like to say like, did you know that there was almost never a time that there was one Roman emperor? The Roman Empire almost always had at least two people holding some form of imperial office. And sometimes that worked great, and sometimes it caused a civil war. But this claim of, like, you know, since the Roman times, there had to be an emperor. It's like, do you know how many? Like, sometimes there were four. Sometimes there were four Roman emperors. So, how, if the Roman Empire didn't just have one person in charge, why do we have to reproduce these structures? Okay, well, now I've just sort of petered out. Ah, damn it. And there's the pun. So I don't know. What do we what do you want to talk about next?
Well, I'm very interested in kind of how you got into this. Like, what was your trigger point or whatever, inspiration for getting into anarchism? Because as an academic, especially as an academic, and in that world, people tend to do what you said, which is to just end up talking about anarchists rather than like writing from the perspective of one, right? And I think about this with like James Scott, for example, right? Like, he refused to call himself an anarchist, but was clearly an anarchist, and he was writing about them. He has a book, Two Cheers for Anarchy, right? And yet he still refused to do it. And I understand there's like some level of academic person, assassination or whatever, if you come out as some, as if you come out as an anarchist, as an academic. And even like Graeber was sort of on the fence around a lot of that stuff, So how did you come into that? And then I guess, do you feel like there are other academics that are using the A word, or do you feel like you have to advocate for it within those frameworks?
Yeah, so I mean, how I came to it, it's interesting. The last time, I did a podcast interview, which was also the first time I'd ever done video, I got asked the same question. And so I've so I that and I have mentioned it from time to time. Essentially what happened, I mean, I'll give the short version, is I was a teacher at a high school, but it was an elite high school, so it was kind of unclear, like, whether we were running it like a college or like a high school. And just during COVID, I got into a feud with my bosses. And actually, let me make this more about ideas than the process. And they were really dumb, because they were saying all sorts of really dumb shit about what the students should be doing during COVID. And they were, making no absolutely no allowances for the mental health struggle. I mean, I had a student who, was caring for her grandmother, who died over the course of that year. The student was the primary caregiver for their grandmother, and that grandmother passed away during that year. And that student was supposed to, be zooming into my class and then, like, run upstairs to make sure her dying grandmother was okay. And the administrators were like, "Yeah, but we have to maintain rigor and academic standards, so you can't really adapt your policies in any way. Everything has to be exactly like if COVID wasn't happening." But the thing, I guess, here's the thing that drove me. And so of course I started reading David Graeber and things like that to make sense of this. But I finally, like, was like, they instituted this, like, really annoying, like, formal process of, saying everything I'd done wrong. And I was like, shit, I'm gonna lose my job. And I went and talked to a lawyer, and the lawyer was like, "No, because you haven't done anything wrong. They've basically made all this up, but they do have tons of power. So what you have to do is just agree that you were bad and you did wrong things, and then you get to keep your job." And I was like, "But I didn't." And he was just like,
Oh my
"Well,
God.
that doesn't matter." And then I said, "Well, I would like to write a rebuttal to everything they said." And he said, "Sure, you can do that. That's fine." And I spent weeks on it. I wrote, I don't know how many thousands of words, and I was just, I mean, I just played the game perfectly. I found all of the rules that they had violated, and I, quoted that. And then I found, all the places where they said I had violated rules, and proved that I hadn't violated any of those rules. And I put it together. I sent it to my lawyer, and he said, "Yeah, this is really, really good." And I sent it to them, and nothing happened. They didn't care. And I was like, "Oh, so all of the rules by which we live by, all of the legal, I've sat through so many times, has someone explained to me that I have to consult the handbook, the faculty handbook, if I want to do this or I want to do that." And then I proved that I had followed the faculty handbook perfectly, and they had violated all the rules. And it was just like, that doesn't matter. And maybe this sounds,
the rules don't apply to them.
Yeah. Right? That's, maybe this sounds silly or naive, but I just like, it's suddenly crystal. I was like, wait a second. You know, I've been voting for technocrats and liking Obama for the past 10 years. And it's just like, all that matters is the pure exercise of power. And if that's what, you know, if that's what liberalism is, if that's what the rule of law and the rules-based order is, then I want nothing, nothing to do with it.
Yeah. So do you still
answer the question?
Yeah, that's great. Do you still work there?
Do you No. I quit that job to start a podcast.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then, you know, I didn't make any money making a podcast. Podcasting is not very lucrative. I mean, I guess depending on who you are. And so since then I've been teaching, and I've been sort of doing this dual thing of teaching classes mostly unrelated to anarchism, although I can sneak it in here and there, and then having this anarchist podcast. In terms of do I speak up? No, I mean, I don't think anyone in my department almost knows, you know, that I am an anarchist, that I have this podcast, whatever. They're all too busy, you know, with their own careers. So for the most part, I have a life as a professor and a life as a anarchist intellectual on the internet, and they don't interact really.
Amazing. Yeah, it's bizarre the way that I think academia works. And I mean, that was something that I was going to ask too, is like, you know, has there been a shift with the Trump administration crackdowns on DEI and all of that kind of stuff? And like, you know, labeling Antifa as terrorism, is there any, you know, have you seen any, you know, anything from that come about in your position?
No, I don't. I mean, look, the matter is, you know, I'm pretty on board with opposing, you know, I need to say this carefully. I'm going to say like, I oppose DEI also, because I do, which is to say, the whole thing that the Trump administration is going after is this like technocratic attempt to make social justice emerge basically with rules that capture people's identity categories. So when they'll say like the Trump administration is going after the left wing, and I'm like, oh no. And then I look and it's like they're going after some lawyer who worked for the Justice Department and is now a professor, a law professor at some fancy pants law school. And I'm like, that's not the left. But I actually haven't seen the left wing persecuted too much. I mean, there are examples, but like when you look at persecution, it's usually people who are teaching that you should ask students their pronouns, which is just like, has become a totally mainstream thing. I have not actually seen much, like the way they define Antifa is like, you don't like the Trump administration. That qualifies you as Antifa. Right. So if someone was going to truly divide the people that I consider the left, which I, you know, count myself a member of, from the liberals and moderates and really persecute the left, I think that would be a problem for me. But as near as I can tell, they define voting for a Democrat as
what you're saying
as leftism. Right. So I don't stand out.
That makes sense.
In that case,
I'm wondering, you know, once Palantir, you know, who are they going to go for first? And, you know, with AI and things like Palantir kind of being able to aggregate people who even use the word anarchy or something like that, or Antifa or anti-fascist or whatever, like who fucking knows how things are going to go. But I do agree with you that there is sort of this like, in a sense, it's actually great to have them saying that Antifa is anybody who opposes Trump, because, you know, great. It's great marketing in a way for Antifa. But then it also actually makes people who are doing things a bit safer, I think, in terms of strength in numbers.
I mean, I think at least for me, a real crackdown on leftists would be a problem. And I mean, the other thing is, I tend to view the people, there's a lot of people out there who are quite authoritarian and just think that the solution to the problem of the right wing. So I'll just give you one example. There's this guy, I think his name is Timothy Snyder. He's this big anti-Trump guy. He was at Princeton or something. He wrote this book, like 20 Lessons on Tyranny and everything. But like lesson number one from Timothy Snyder is like, you have to know the truth. And once you know the truth, they can't lie to you. I think he's trying to be sort of Orwellian of like, you know, when they say up is down, you know that it's actually up.
Right. Yes.
But for me, the claim that there is a truth that can be known, and some people know that truth and other people don't, and the people who know that truth should have political power, and the people who don't know the truth should not have political power. That's tyranny right there. Like,
right. Well, that's all the framework around what is truth. I think a better thing might be like liars should be, you know, it should be known who's lying, not like what is the definitive truth, but what is the manipulation of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm totally happy to say like you should call out bullshit and lying is bad. But when you start off like we have an apparatus for truth that is correct, and unfortunately Trump isn't using that apparatus of truth, so he's bad and wrong.
Right.
But if Hillary Clinton were president, then truth would be known. And things would be good. This is like, that's...
She never lies.
Yeah. this idea that there's, you know, and obviously this comes up. I mean, actually, this will bring us around. This will bring us around to rewilding. Because I noticed we haven't been talking about rewilding. So this is one of the things. I mean, one of the things that's interesting to me is troubling to me about when you talk about the pop culture version of rewilding is it's usually pretty right coded. And
totally.
It's like there is an apparatus of truth. That apparatus of truth is run by Anthony Fauci or whoever. And they're lying to you and they're totally just in the pay of the giant food corporations and medical corporations, and they're horrible, and you need to get away from these, you know, basically fascists who are destroying your life. And I'm just sitting here like nodding along like this all sounds good. And then it's like, and so no, the only thing you should do is eat meat, and you should make sure to be cruel to every woman you encounter. And then you've taken back your primal nature. And it's like, so how do you deal with the fact that rewilding sounds like something like the Tate brothers would be into?
Right. Exactly. Well, and I mean, essentially that's to a degree, that is what happened in the late 2010s. You know, a lot of different influencers sort of matched up with this sort of MAHA health movement, you know, because that's sort of where a lot of the crossover is. But there was an article, I have a Google alert, so whenever the word rewilding is used in the news, I get an aggregate at the end of the week that tells me what it's being used for. And I forget when it was. It was sometime, maybe 2015 or something like that. A headline came through that said, "The Wolves of Vinland want you to rewild yourself." If you're not familiar with the Wolves of Vinland, they're a like white nationalist like motorcycle. I don't know. I don't even know how to describe them because they change around a little bit, but there used to be a chapter here outside of Portland. They do kind of like goofy fake Viking reenactment type shit. And they have like their more sort of overt national framework is called Operation Werewolf. And they have like gyms where they recruit people for their white nationalist agenda. And so you have, this sort of, crossover in a couple of areas where you have the rejection of authority, you know, the lack of trust in authority, which is an important thing because we are being lied to to a large degree. The rejection of capitalist framework of things like the FDA and Monsanto, who work hand in hand to promote horrible toxic shit that people put in their bodies and spray on our food and all that kind of stuff. So you have like a little bit of that overlap there, but then you have these people who have another agenda. and their agenda is to dominate. Their agenda is not to liberate. They want to be the people in charge, the arbiters of truth. And so it's a sort of magician thing, a sleight of hand, right? Where they can provide you with the same pain points, is what they call them in like marketing terms, you know. Yeah. They know this, the same pain points, but then their solutions are the same thing repackaged, you know. I mean, this is how actually it's funny, because when Al Gore's movie An Inconvenient Truth came out, I was like so disturbed by it that the end of that movie was like, buy light bulbs. And everybody was like, oh, we just have to like change the way we consume, our change our consumer habits, and that will like somehow stop climate change. Like, it was the same kind of thing where it takes a very serious idea. While it might be mainstreaming the idea, it's repackaging a solution into the same fucking problem that got us there to begin with, you know? And I just see that over and over again with basically everything. There's like this essay that I like link people to a lot. It's called like, oh man, what's it called? Geeks, Mops, and Sociopaths in Cultural Evolution. And it's basically like what happens to a subculture when it reaches a certain number of what they call MOPs, which members of the public. Like, there's the geeks and the fanatics and like the creators who make a subculture. And then it gains in popularity to the point where it starts attracting people who are like, not actually, they're like consumers. They want to like have part of it, but they don't actually want to be of the scene or whatever, right? They don't want to play the music or create the music. They just want to buy the CD and then listen to it at home. They're not even going to go to a show, maybe, you know. They might buy a t-shirt or something, right? And there's like some sort of mathematical equation that this author says is like the breaking point of subcultures, where once there's enough MOPs that are there, like the sociopaths show up because they realize they can monetize it and take the new cool thing and turn it into a product that they can sell, burn through the existence, you know, the popularity of it, the fad part of it, and then leave with lots of money at the end and leave the subculture, you know, smoldering in ashes or whatever, right? Because they never fucking cared to begin with. And so you see that happening with the cultural rewilding, and you see it happening with like, you know, social media entrepreneurs, but you also see it with these white supremacists who have a secret agenda, or, you know, white nationalists, whatever they want to call themselves, to trap people back in. And they use exactly what you were saying, this the kind of social Darwinism of like men have always dominated women or something like that, which is like very easily disprovable. You know, there's a couple of I don't think he calls himself a white nationalist anymore, but there's one person in particular who was the head of the chapter of the Wolves of Vindolin in Portland for a long time. And I don't even want to mention his name, because I just don't like promoting people at all, like platforming them. So I'm just going to talk about him. But, you know, he's written lots of books on so-called masculinity, and he calls himself an anthropologist. And every time I open one, it's like, it's interesting, because there will be points of agreement, right? Which is that pain point. It's that point of recognizing the problem. But then the next paragraph of solution is like batshit crazy, and also not based in any kind of like back upable, agreed upon science, at the very least. You know, like if we're looking at human history and we look at like even contemporary hunter-gatherers, immediate return hunter-gatherers who live egalitarian existences where men and women are equal and share duties for the most part, you know, there's no domination in those societies. And that's theoretically and, you know, evidence-based how humans lived for 2 million years prior to the advent of agrarian civilizations. And even then, there are some agrarian civilizations that have been relatively egalitarian as well. So the idea that this is some, you know, that this is the product of evolution that is natural to dominate is just, you know, one of the biggest farces, I think, that these types of movements try to project. And so the way I, you know, to kind of circle back, the way I've tried to combat it is by just trying to come back to the storytelling, you know, to just come back to the storytelling, because not everybody's going to read, you know, a stack of anthropological books on this kind of stuff, you know. And so part of it is, for me, you know, I like to let the academics speak for themselves and talk about the studies, because I'm not an academic in the sense that I don't work for the academy or anything. Although I did get a, you know, I did get my first academic article published. So I guess in that sense, I am a part of academia now. But I think elevating these other voices of the actual experts, the people who actually have who've studied and lived with people of different cultures who understand the history, the archaeology of all of it, and getting them to share to an audience outside of the concept of people reading their book and having to like suss through the academic jargon to understand it. But it's an uphill battle because our society loves the idea of dominance. It justifies the existence of the structures that we live in. And so if we have a different story, the only people who are going to be receptive to that are the people who are damaged by or perceive themselves as damaged by the larger culture. You know, I think this is why white men in particular have this sort of disconnect with this and perceive themselves as superior, because that gives them, even though they might be experiencing some of the poor aspects of civilization, they still see themselves represented at the top. They still identify with the benefits of the culture at large. And so it's really fucking hard to get people that think that they have the power within the situation, even if they fucking don't, they just think they do. It's even harder to get them to see the other way. But, you know, for everybody else who's subjugated in a much more overt way, I think it's a lot easier to bring these ideas to them. And so I focus on sharing with other people. However, yeah, lately I have been trying to figure out more how to get through to white men, but I don't have a solution yet other than to just keep doing what I'm already doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think that's right about storytelling. And that's why, you know, Graeber drew me in to the anarchist movement and you know, Kropotkin tells in the book Mutual Aid a pretty compelling story to me that does all of human and indeed non-human history. But Graeber just loves these little examples. I mean, anyone who's listened to my podcast heard them a bunch of times. Like, when you get on the bus, are you striving for hierarchical dominance? You're probably not. When if you've got a job and you're working with other people, are you striving for hierarchical dominance? You're probably not. Now, there's a good chance. I mean, I run this all the time. I had this student one time who was like, he said, I really have two core beliefs. It's I believe in the love of Jesus, and I believe in the need for competition. And I was just like,
oh, Jesus Christ.
But I mean, obviously this kid, whether it was Sunday school or regular school or whatever, I mean, received both of these things mm-hmm. as not just fundamental to him, but obviously in this really crucial way aligned. And we have mm-hmm. this ridiculous thing called Western civilization, which is, you know, rules the world right now because of how efficient it is, because some Europeans figured out the right way to be in the world, used this to enslave everyone else while destroying the natural environment. And if you don't like it, it's because you're some sort of hippie who doesn't understand that this is just what evolution intended for us all to have. And somehow Jesus got, you know, roped into this. Right. This itinerant shoeless guy who preached that the world was almost over, but until it was over, all slaves should be free and everyone should just live peacefully. I mean, I don't know. I'd never thought this before. I don't know whether Jesus advocated a hunter-gatherer lifestyle. He sure as fuck didn't advocate farming. Like, right. Absolutely not at all. And the fact that these two things have been woven together, some bizarre amalgam of Adam Smith and Jesus, justifies the domination of every human being on the planet by whoever has access to the most nuclear weapons. I'm trying to tear that down. It seems like it should be torn down.
Yeah. Well, and it seems like you're saying, you know, I feel like it's self-evident to certain people. but there are, and I think, you know, this conversation, this particular topic has seemed to be coming up lately a lot for me, which is that there's a kind of core belief, I think, with people who do not have, who do not strive for competition, who do not strive for status to crazy degrees, that like everybody just wants the same thing. You know, we all have the same needs. We all need, you know, not necessarily comfort, but like food, love, belonging, you know, all these things. We don't want to destroy the ecosystem. We want to have relationship to place, blah, blah, blah. And there's this we, you know, and I really do think that most people would fall into that category. And I think there are sociopaths. I think there are narcissists. I think it's essentially a form of like brain damage, or, you know, where people don't have those pro-social qualities that many humans have evolved throughout our evolution. And I think it's those particular people who obviously not only benefit the most from a hierarchical society like ours, because they don't feel the same levels of empathy. They feel a strive for competition. So when they are able to dominate others, they get off on it. Like, they get off on the idea of, you know, which is what, you know, it's like this whole thing about ICE, you know, right now, like, what is the point of it? The point is the violence. The point for these people is the horror. You know, because they enjoy it, because what other way do they show their status in this society than being able to just do violence to people without any recourse, you know? And there are societies where status building and competition is on giving, you know, the people who give the most receive the most sort of like status. And that's in and of itself can be fucked up too. You know, but overall, like if your status and your competition is like, how can we be better friends to each other? How can we be better community members? You're going to dismantle hierarchy collaboratively. You're going to prevent those people who want to fuck it up from becoming the people in power, you know? And I don't know. There's this thing of like, what do we do about these people, you know, that are these sociopaths at the top? You know, I've interviewed a couple experts on like nonviolent resistance and things like that. And I just don't know, you know, at this level, how to stop things other than waiting for it to collapse in and of itself, which is, you know, I know you interviewed Luke Kemp, Goliath's Curse, and I've interviewed him as well. But that was kind of one of the things that I talked to him about, too, at the end of that book, because, like, you know, he has some solutions. And I was like, did they make you write the solutions at the end? Because they're like, you know, they're good solutions to the degree that I like agree with them as things. But like what I said too is it's just like the amount of power that the people have now, there's no way that like we could vote our way out of this kind of a thing. There's just no way, you know? Yeah. So I don't know. There's really no, I don't know what your thoughts on any of that are.
I have some thoughts, and then, you know, my way into this problem, the problem of the sociopaths, really comes from this philosopher named Tien Nguyen, who I've had on my podcast before. And essentially, so he's a philosopher of games, but he uses James C. Scott's analysis to analyze games. And just to sort of simplify, I mean, I often say the slogan is, I don't know whether Tien Nguyen wrote this anywhere. I think this might be my formulation, but what I say is you get what you score for. So if there's points being given for something, then people are going to do the thing that points are given to if they value the points, which, you know, in a game that you're playing with your friends, you probably shouldn't value the points that much, because, you know, you'll start acting like a sociopath and your friends, sure, your friends will hate you. On the other hand, if you are playing a game with your friends and you're just like, no, I don't mind, you go ahead, I'm going to let you buy this property in Monopoly, then actually that ruins the game. You got to be a participant in a rules-based society, you have to accept to some extent, you know, what the rules are. So my formulation, so like James C. Scott is like, you know, if you're the goal of your forest is to have the straightest trees that grow the fastest, if that's how you define a good forest and that's what you're scoring for, that is what you're going to get. That doesn't make it a good forest, but it is, you know, if you've set up a system that scores for something, you're going to get it. If you've designed a system, a worldwide system of human relationships that says let's call points a combination of, you know, money and status. They can be interchanged, but they're not necessarily interchangeable. And the more sociopathically you behave, the more points you are going to get. Then you're going to get a society of sociopaths. I'm not arguing that there are not people who are going to be sociopaths anyway. Undoubtedly, a world of human beings is going to produce sociopaths.
Yes.
But if you've ever played the game Monopoly, you behaved while you were playing that game as a sociopath. And you behaved as a sociopath. You probably were not playing it against strangers. You were probably playing it against the people you love most in the world. That's who most people play Monopoly with, not like casual acquaintances. And your goal was to destroy them. And that felt natural to you because you were playing a game, the goal of which was to destroy them. And there were no long-term consequences, or maybe, you know, there's people who don't speak to their family anymore after one too many Monopoly destructions. So if you've created this thing called capitalism, and you've told literally every child, so first of all, Jesus loves you, and also you should destroy everyone. That's how you can be successful. Then if you're scoring for sociopathy, you're going to have a world of sociopaths. And that's why I'm just trying to explain to people that cooperation can work, because they're not actually, to go back to the James C. Scott thing, and then I can stop here. They're not scoring for the best forest. They're scoring for a bunch of trees that all look the same and are very tall and narrow, and they're calling it the best forest. And then you try and say to them, you know, that that's a forest fire waiting to happen, and it's going to have no biodiversity, and everyone's going to starve and die if you have too many of these forests. But I'm not anti-forest. It's just maybe the way you have imagined what you want to encourage in your forest is a mistake. And the fact that sociopaths are rising to the top is just because you're step one, let's define the best person in the world as a sociopath. Step two, let's create a system in which we can find the best sociopath. Step three is the world we live in.
Yeah. It makes me wonder too, you know, so obviously, you know, what will happen is that we will have to create a culture that encourages the antithesis of sociopathy, which is, you know, again, I would consider rewilding. That is a process of rewilding 100%. You know, so that's interesting too, because, you know, a lot of people, when they think about rewilding, are like, oh, it must mean like I'm going to go back and live like a hunter gatherer again or something like that. And, you know, there are people that are trying to do that, more power to them. But, you know, to me, rewilding doesn't mean that. To me, rewilding is about going back to the relationship with place and each other that we had prior to, you know, I say civilization, but I think the way people are starting to define capitalism now is the same thing. I've noticed a lot of people now sort of like expanding the definition of civilization to match sort of the definitions that I came to through the like anti-civ thing in the early 2000s. But, yeah, you know, we're going to have to completely rechange our society. And to me, that is rewilding. It doesn't mean running away to live like a hunter-gatherer. You know, first of all, it's probably not even possible for most people. You know, there's 8 billion of us. We are going to have some sort of transitional agricultural, horticultural, you know, pastoral subsistence that'll probably arise both out of need, you know, a necessity and choice. I think it'll be a combination of things. But the social structure, to me, is the thing that prevents anything from moving. And so that is the most fundamental part of rewilding is you know, transitioning our social structure from a hierarchy to a kinship, non-hierarchical format. But, you know, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot lately, too. It's like you mentioned the forest thing. So that got me thinking about this thing of like how we value different places and how capitalism. And this is why I think of capitalism as a little different than like civilization in general, because I think, you know, indigenous people can and have produced agrarian civilizations that have destroyed their own land base. Like the word indigenous is an interesting thing a lot of people tend to now sort of use it interchangeably with hunter-gatherers or like sustainable life ways or things like that. But, you know, there are plenty of indigenous societies that damaged their landscapes. I think the differing thing is that when you live in a place, you have to deal with the results of that damage. And then you can reflect on it and transform as a society. I think of like the Mayan civilization as a great example. There's like a really good book called The Maya Forest Garden. And it's basically about regenerative forest management that is of, you know, practices of how they subsisted post decline of their civilization, you know? And that to me is a prime example of like indigenous people who like go through these processes. And but the fact that they're indigenous allows them to transform into something more resilient over time. Whereas with capitalism, you know, it just throws people, displaces people into places that they are not from, and sort of gives this idea that we can just go wherever. And it's sort of like the biblical idea of locusts, right? Where they just come and consume a thing and then move on. Whereas like hunter-gatherers or horticulturalists or, you know, Sweden agriculturalists and stuff who live in rotating places throughout the year, they're always in those places. Even if they're nomadic, they're still coming back to the same types of circuits, you know, and working those same parts of the land. So they can see long-term results of things and they understand where their food comes from. But when we started, you know, in the late 1400s with colonizing all, when, you know, European expansion and colonization, it really led to this idea of like people, placeless people consuming the resources of a particular place. And it's taken, what, 500 years. And I think we're reaching the point where all of those resources are fucking consumed. And now the people, the settlers who are in on indigenous land or whatever, are having this sort of like moment of like the global system is collapsing. They're realizing they have to fucking figure out how to live in their place because we're not going to be able to get bananas forever. You know, like all of the things that are extracted and shipped across the world, like we have this idea where we don't even see the destruction that we're causing because we don't live there. You know, and I think that that's changing. I think we've destroyed so much of the ecosystems around the earth that people are stuck now in these places that have been devastated and they're having to reframe things. And I think that is a huge part of, you know, the momentum that's going to pick up with cultural rewilding and indigenous, you know, decolonizing is a great example of that. Like the decolonized movement or land back movement, I think are like, you know, can move integrated in a same kind of way. Anyway, I'm thinking about that because you mentioned the forests all looking the same way. And I'm like, that's like this extractive mentality where you don't live there. You know, if you live in the forest, it needs to have a lot of different biodiversity that you're getting subsistence from. It's not just trees, you know?
Yeah, the forest, I mean, the forest is essentially, they came up with a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. And then they wanted the forest to resemble the spreadsheet as right. closely totally. As possible, which is an inversion of what you would think, you know, and it was called scientific forestry. And you would right. think scientific forestry would have been creating a description of the forest that resembled the forest as closely as possible. But it turns out that's hard. You know how much work it would be to successfully explain what a forest is like? It's much easier to make a forest very simple. And then your spreadsheet can accurately describe the forest up until the inevitable fire comes, and then you have to delete the spreadsheet, and you know, and then yeah, and then maybe you start talking, maybe you start studying indigenous forestry practices, not because you understand that you need to change the way that you're living in the world, but because you hope that you can make your stupid capitalist forest a little more fireproof.
Yeah, right. Next time. That's where they're at right now, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even, you know, hiring indigenous people to burn things, you know, that's kind of where they're at here in Oregon and California and Washington is like, you know, rekindling a lot of those traditional life ways. But again, it's all still, I think, profit driven or, you know, they don't want the housing, the neighborhoods that they've built in fire prone areas to burn down, like the Palisades fire in California or the LA fires, you know, like they're trying to do these back burns and all these traditional burns, but they still don't quite understand the full scope of what it means to be place-based. And so they're going to be missing the point, I think, even if it's yeah. still great. It's still great that they're employing indigenous people and elevating those ideas to a level, because I think maybe then it's still moving a needle of some kind in a direction that will be helpful as our decline intensifies, at least in certain areas. So yeah. I want to ask you.
Okay.
I want to shift gears a little bit and just kind of be like, you know, what's do you have like a kind of like an elevator pitch of everyday anarchism? Do you have like, you know, has anybody been like, what are your top five like things that one person could do that would encourage more anarchic lifestyle or whatever? You know what I mean? Like people ask me that with rewilding, but I'm curious if you've got your, you know.
Yeah, no. I mean, the short answer is no, is people ask me this. And what I usually end up doing is talking about what I've done basically in the classroom. So here's the quick pitch is, and maybe I should give people, you know, maybe I should give you five. I mean, you know, start a garden, meet your neighbors. I mean, those are obvious things, but here's how I would put it. So again, rightly or wrongly, and possibly wrongly, I'm a big picture, big idea thinker. You know, famously, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau, you know, they were friends. Emerson was Thoreau's mentor, and Emerson was the big idea guy, and Thoreau was the one who really put a lot of it into practice. And just about everyone I know is like, you know, Emerson is hard to read and he's so highfalutin, and I just love Thoreau. And I'm over here and I'm like, I can't get through five pages of Thoreau. I don't want to hear about the butterflies. I want to hear about what experience is and how it transforms us. So that's unfortunately, in some ways, the Everyday Anarchism podcast label is a lie, because I'm very much not an everyday thinker, although I try and have them. Yes. I try and have them on the podcast as much as I can.
Yeah.
But here's my big picture thing. You're living in a world. All of you are living in a world that prioritizes, as we've been talking about, domination, hierarchy, power, control. And no matter who you are or where you are, you have the choice to contribute to it in some small way or resist it in some small way. I mean, you can just see, even if you think you have no power at all in the institutional sense, if you are, you know, a high school student, and there are people who are not being as treated well as other people for whatever reason, and you try and reach out to those people and get to know them and find out their story, as opposed to joining the cool kids and laughing at them, to me, that is an act of resistance. And when I say this, the more Marxist people will say, like, well, I mean, that sounds nice, but we must seize the means of production and revolutionize the system. I mean, fine, maybe they'll get there someday. But I see every day people who have at every stage in their life seen nothing but, you know, the hand designed to crush them and been asked to participate in it. The thing I say is, you know, I do my best to make my classroom a space where people are not being judged. They're not competing. I can't not give grades and keep my job. So I do give grades. But I reduce the pressure of grades, honestly, a little bit more every year. And it goes terribly, because the students say, but how do I get extra credit? How do I get a higher grade? And that tells me that for the previous 18 years of their life, they were only taught that they had to be a winner. And they were taught that winners are better and get more and deserve more. So every scenario you are in, you have the power to push it a little away from that hierarchical domination. And this probably is going to sound totally empty, but you can be nice to the people who are bagging your groceries, right? And that is supposed to be, you know, just like bullshit, and it doesn't matter, and it's not systematic change. I agree that it's not systemic change, being nice to the people who bag your groceries or the bus driver. But you'll be amazed at how many people are not nice to the bus driver. And depending on what your job has a real good chance of being useless. And the bus driver is not being useless. And you can vote for candidates who will pay the bus driver more, and you can try and do all sorts of things to make the bus driver's life better, including standing up when people are yelling at the bus driver. And that it starts there. And again, I speak to people on a weekly basis who are like, that's nothing. That's bullshit. If we're not seizing the power and making the world better, we're not going to get anything from it. I'm convinced that it's not nothing. It's not everything. Being nicer to everyone and resisting in small ways every day will not accumulate to the fall of capitalism and the rise of the utopia. But you got to start somewhere.
Yes, I agree with that. You made me think of two things. One is a friend of mine asked me once, like, do you think there's ever going to be like a rewilded, like, economic structure, or like an anarchist structure, you know, social structure that exists? And I was like, I thought about it for a minute and I was like, you know what? It does exist. It is the baseline of humans.
Yeah.
There is an anarchist economy. If you read like Rebecca Solnit's book, Paradise Built in Hell, the problem isn't that there isn't an anarchist economy. It exists. It's just that there's this other thing called the state that's on top of it.
Yeah.
That forces us to engage with it. But the anarchist economy is a continuous thing that just exists. That is the baseline of human social interaction. So, you know, whether it's a fucking GoFundMe or, you know, a charity or mutual aid or whatever it is that's happening, there's an economy of anarchism that is constant. And so when people are like, what can I do? I don't want to like go up against the state. I'm afraid or whatever, right? Or they don't believe it's going to make a difference or any of those kind of things. I'm like, where are you putting your time and energy? You know, yeah. Stop putting it in this thing, like you're saying, and put it in this other thing, you know? And once you start to notice the things like, oh yeah, talking to your neighbors, like sharing food. That's my thing, is I'm just like, share food. That is like literally one of the things that makes humans different than our other ape relatives, is that we share food. That is like a core thing. And that's part of our egalitarian socialization through history, through our evolution. So, you know, just getting that out there and getting that into people's idea that, like, when all this other bullshit goes away, this is going to continue, and it's still here right now, and you can tap into it, right? Like, you can tap into that anarchist economic structure, or however you want to call it, you know, social network or whatever, you know, it's there. And so, yeah. Then the second thing you made me think of in terms of like its impact is something that James Scott said in the book, Weapons of the Weak, which was that, like, there's actually no way to even really understand or measure the impact of passive resistance, because how do you catalog things that people are not doing as a thing that helps destroy an empire? If somebody's like calling in sick, or they're slowing, you know, dragging their feet through something, like, there's so many things that are passive resistance, and there's no way to fully understand or appreciate how much those things can actually do to collapse an empire. Because we only ever think about the scale of like the warfare that, or disease, or, you know, well, there's certain things that can like collapse an empire that can be measured. And they're usually like the violent resistance and things like that, or things that are very visible. But invisible resistance is something that it's invisible. It's almost impossible to measure. And so, yes, all of those things have an impact, whether you actually are able to see them or not, you know? And I just, yeah, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
So something you made me think of, and then we can head towards the end. So I'm reading a book right now. called Transcendence for Beginners. And it's by a philosopher and biographer named Claire Carlisle. I think I'm going to have her on the podcast soon, but we're still working out dates. And, you know, she worked on this philosopher Spinoza, who I've never been able to make any sense of, but David Graeber was always very clear that Spinoza was his favorite philosopher. Mm. And there's this, you know, famous British novelist, her name is George Eliot. That's her pen name. I'm blanking on her actual name. And, you know, she wrote these long, boring, as far as my students are concerned, novels that were just about like everyday people. The most famous one is called Middlemarch. And if you, pick them up and read them, you would, it would not be obvious to you that they were highly influenced by this esoteric philosopher, Baruch Spinoza. But according to Claire Carlisle, essentially Spinoza was trying to write a counter philosophy in which what mattered was the unfolding of regular people's lives. And what George Eliot was trying to do is just say, like, watch this person's life, watch each time they made a difference in the world. You'll never be able to see it over the 80 years of their life, but I can write this, this narrative that maybe seems like not that much happens in it, and it doesn't really amount to anything. But what it amounts to is a person living in a community, making a small difference with basic human decency every day. And that looks like, you know, something small or immaterial, but it's in fact, you know, unless you plan on becoming world famous or the general of an army or the CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and God, I hope no one listening to this ever does any of those things, then a life well lived, making a difference for the people around you every day, that's as good as it gets. Mm-hmm. And that's not weakness. And maybe it's every day, but it's a very specific and powerful kind of every day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome.
Okay. Now you have this to tell people
great.
tell about your Kickstarter before we go.
Yeah. So for the last 10 years, I've been teaching a class called Rewilding 101. Covers a lot of the stuff that we kind of meandered through in this course or in this conversation. There's a lot of other stuff that I talk about, ecological stuff, deep history, examples of people around the world doing rewilding things. And I'm trying to turn it into an 8-part documentary film series. And so right now we have a Kickstarter that's starting up April 1st through the end of April. And all the funds that go into that are going to go to this documentary to produce the documentary. It's also an online course. So when we complete the documentary, it'll have a course companion that comes with it that people can complete on their own. And then there's another level where people will be able to do more of an interactive thing and go through the whole course with a cohort and be able to do Q&A with me and stuff like that. So yeah, if any of the stuff in the conversation interested you, you want to check it out. I also offer those classes just kind of in person or online via Zoom from rewildportland.com. I don't know how long it's going to take us to complete this film series. So right now we're saying a year. But yeah, the Kickstarter's up. You can go watch the video. It's pretty goofy. And yeah, thanks for sharing conversation. And
I mean, I'll just say, you know, you shared some of the stuff with me. I was impressed. It's good. It's good stuff. I'm looking forward to it. And I think you should be proud of what you're doing.
Awesome. Thank you. You too.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter.